I don't mind Jesus, but I'm not so keen on his fan club. I don't know if you've ever heard anyone say anything like that. Someone said that to me once, a guy called Matt. We were in a group for people investigating Christianity, and that was his point of view. You might have heard something similar. That might be what you think. The point is simple. His point was Jesus might have said lots of good things, but I don't find the people who follow him live up to that standard. For lots of people, their view of church and groups of Christians isn't positive. And they might have reasons to think like that. My parents have some friends who went to a church service one Christmas, and after the carol service there were mince pies and refreshments. However, when they went to go and partake of the refreshments, they were told, no, don't touch those. Those are for the church people, not for visitors. And unsurprisingly, they had a bit of a problem with church for a while after that. It's possible for people who claim to be Christians to act in off-putting ways. Sometimes, however, that is not the reason for people's negative view. That wasn't the reason for Matt, this guy that I knew. Matt, who said to me, I don't mind Jesus, but I'm not so keen on his fan club. Actually, he'd never had a bad experience of church. He had some impressions. He had some impressions about, firstly, what Jesus was like, and secondly, about what Christians were like. But the thing is, that's all they were. They were impressions, and they were assumptions. We've been looking at Matthew's Gospel in our morning meetings over the past few months, and we've been looking at the real Jesus, the Jesus of eyewitness history. And the real Jesus that we've been reading about actually said and did things that Matt, this guy I knew, wasn't so keen on when he found out about the real Jesus. We've read in Matthew's Gospel things about a day of judgment, things about the need to give up everything and follow Jesus to have eternal life. Real Jesus of history can be different to people's impressions, but so can the real community of Jesus' people. We've been watching, particularly over the last few weeks in the Gospel, as Jesus has been creating a new community of his followers. We saw in chapter 16 that this community is called the church, that Jesus is building it, and that it's all centered around him. And now we get to chapter 18, and we get this question from the disciples that we read earlier. Who, verse 1, the disciples asked Jesus, who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? I wonder if you can see what they're thinking. I reckon it goes something like this. I think they're thinking, well, if Jesus is making this new community, if Jesus is reordering society, how do we get ahead? Every community has more important people and less important people. Every community has ranks and positions. They're probably thinking we're doing quite well because we're Jesus' first followers. We're his closest friends. We're probably going to be pretty important in the new community, but we've got to make sure. We need to know what we have to do to be up there in the new system. And Jesus takes the opportunity of their question to teach through this whole chapter, what is his community really like? What is life like in the new community that Jesus is building? And I think we find that what the real Jesus says his real community is like is a challenge. It's a challenge to the view of Christians that many people have. We're going to look at it under three headings, and hopefully you've got one of the outlines that's available. Three headings, three instructions that Jesus gives to his disciples about life in the new community. And the first one's this. Jesus says to his disciples, be little ones who care for little ones. Be little ones who care for little ones. And that's covering verses 1 to 14. So this question from the disciples at the start, I think, assumes two things. When they say who's the greatest in the new community, firstly, they're assuming this community works like any other. You've got to climb to the top. And secondly, I think implicitly they're assuming we're doing pretty well at that because we're some of the first in. But I think Jesus challenges them on both of those assumptions. So verse 2, he called a little child and had him stand among them. And he said, I tell you the truth, unless you change and become like little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Therefore, whoever humbles himself like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. On both things they assumed, the disciples, they're wrong. Firstly, this community is not like other communities. This community is nothing like any other community. In what other society is a little child the example to be followed? In what kind of community are those who are humble like little children considered the greatest? A child is someone to be looked after, not to be looked up to. But Jesus takes a little child as his there and then visual illustration and says, you know what people in my community are trying really hard to be like? They want to be like this child. This, we'll see, is very different from other communities. But the disciples are also wrong to assume about their status in the new community. It was there in verse 3, Jesus said, unless you change and become like little children, you'll never enter the kingdom of heaven. Far from being up there in the new community, Jesus is challenging if they're even going to be in the new community. Jesus is saying, right now, your mindset, disciples, is totally different from the people who will be in the new community. And unless you change, you're not going to be there. Because the new community is made up of little ones. Little ones, that's the phrase that Matthew uses here to describe Jesus' followers and elsewhere in his gospel as well. Little ones. And I wonder what we think about that language. Doesn't seem like a compliment necessarily, little one. Compliments in our society go like this. He's the big cheese, the big boss, he's a big presence, she's a big name. Big is a compliment, little's not. Jesus says, if you want to be part of the new community that I'm building, you have to be a little one. You have to be humble, like a little child. A little child doesn't stand on their own power or reputation because they don't have any. They know they're dependent. And that's what people who follow Jesus are to be like, he says. What kind of community does that result in? Well, if you're not concerned about your own power or position or reputation, if you're no longer concerned with pushing yourself forward, then you're freed to put that energy instead into looking out for others in the community. And I think that's just what these verses, this chapter shows us. This new community is a place of little ones who care for other little ones. Jesus unfolds for us the opposite attitude to how can I get further ahead than them. The opposite attitude says, verse 5, how can I welcome them in? Whoever welcomes a little child like this in my name welcomes me. Little ones welcome little ones. They welcome people whom others would call insignificant and unimportant. Jesus' community welcomes people like that. If you think about it, there is no logical reason that an atheist should be kind to a Down syndrome child. I'm not saying that they wouldn't be, but there's no logical reason for it. Natural selection hasn't been kind to them, so why should I? The Christian community, on the other hand, is totally different. The Christian community has a hugely powerful reason to welcome little ones, people who would be considered insignificant in society. The community of people who know they are little ones welcomes other little ones. This attitude says, verses 6 and 7, how can I avoid, at any cost, making little ones stumble? Verses 6 and 7 show us that sin is a very serious thing. Jesus uses very extreme examples to show us that. If you cause a little one to sin, says Jesus, it would be better if you were thrown in the sea to drown. Because little ones don't climb over each other to get to the top, not caring about what happens to others. Little ones care deeply about helping each other not to stumble. This attitude of those in the community says, how can I bring back a little one who's wandering? Little ones caring for little ones say, how can I bring back a little one who's wandering? Glance over verses 10 to 14. In verse 10, Jesus says to the disciples, see that you don't look down on one of these little ones. Well, that would be the outcome of their attitude, wouldn't it? If I'm asking who's the greatest, if I'm trying to be the greatest, it's going to be very hard for me not to look down on those I've got past and they're now beneath me. To show us what the opposite attitude is, Jesus tells the parable about the man with 100 sheep and one that gets lost, and he leaves the 99 to go after the lost one. And his punchline is in verse 14. If the Father God in heaven cares for his little ones, each and every one of them, so much, and is so willing that they not be lost, he's not willing that any of them be lost. If God doesn't look down on little ones but cares for them like that, that's how we should, as little ones, care for one another. The opposite of looking down on them is caring, is longing that none of them be lost. This is what life in the new community is like, is little ones. Caring for little ones, not looking down on each other, not clambering over each other, not causing one another to stumble, welcoming one another, protecting one another, going after any that are in trouble. When you've abolished the climb to the top, when you've made humility the defining characteristic, well, then you can have a place, a community, where radical caring for one another becomes possible. And that's Jesus' new community. And Jesus is teaching his disciples that's what it's like, that's what they need to be like. But there's a sharp edge to what he's saying. There's a warning here. Because being like this is not an optional part of following Jesus. It's not an optional part of being a Christian. That's the point of what we saw in verse 3. He says to them, unless you change and become like this, then you won't enter the kingdom. The underlying question here is not just what's life like in the new community, but who's in? Who's in the new community? That's why there's this extreme language in this chapter about cutting off your hand if it causes you to sin, and about the danger of being thrown into eternal fire. Jesus is waking his disciples up. Even as he teaches them about life in the new community, the key issue is who's going to be there? Who will be in? Because this is what will make Jesus' community different. It is going to be 100% made up of little ones. That's why there won't be rank or position or self-importance. And that is challenging. It's challenging for those of us who are Christians. If we're a Christian, we're a little one. To be a Christian is to accept, is to have to have accepted the offer of free forgiveness from God. To be a Christian, you have to have humbled yourself to say, I can't work my way into right relationship with God. I can't achieve this on my own. I have to receive it from someone who's done it for me. But of course, on any given day, at a given time, we're going to be doing better or worse, I guess, at living that out. We're not perfect yet, and so we imperfectly reflect the truth about ourselves. And Jesus reminds us, you are a little one. If you're following me, you are a little one. So be a little one. Care for other little ones. That's what the new community should be like, and that's challenging. It's also challenging, I guess, for those who might have a different impression of Christians and churches. For anyone who has an impression of Christians as self-righteous and snooty and looking down on others, Jesus challenges that. That's not what his new community is like. It's not just it's not what it should be like, it's not what it is like. And for anyone who's met people who claim to be followers of Jesus and don't live like that, I think we have to consider, according to what Jesus says here, they're probably not followers of Jesus at all. It's not that Jesus' people are perfect, but those in the new community to get in have to be little ones. And we'll reflect that. Be little ones caring for little ones, says Jesus. I think secondly, Jesus says to his new community, be brothers who win back big ones. We're going to look over verses 15 to 20. Be brothers who win back big ones. Now, the situation in view in these five verses is when someone in Jesus' new community wrongs someone else in the new community, which underlines, of course, that Jesus isn't talking about a perfect place. He's not talking about a perfect community of perfect people. He's not saying church will be perfect. But look at what he says about how his people are supposed to deal with imperfect moments. Verse 15, if your brother sins against you, go and show him his fault just between the two of you. If he listens to you, you've won your brother over. Firstly, the little one in the community is to consider the person in the wrong as a brother or a sister. There's a family affection and a bond, even in this bad situation. And look at the outcome that's desired. It's the desire is verse 15, that they listen and that they're won over. You want to win your brother back. Not rub their wrongdoing in their face, but win them over to a changed heart. Jesus says in this situation, go to them privately. Don't make their wrongdoing public. And the desire is that it ends there. If that doesn't work, and there are two further levels that Jesus says the matter needs to be taken to. Firstly, verse 16, two or three others get involved. And then the third level, the whole church gets involved. But at each level, notice, the aim of the process is the same. Verse 17, if he refuses to listen to the two or three, tell the church. If he refuses to listen to the church, treat as you would a pagan. But the point is, each time the desire is that they listen. Each level this is taken to is trying to get this person to listen. The desire is that they listen and that they're won back. In a sense, you could say that this person who's done something wrong, who sinned against another, they're being a big one. They're not being a little one. They're not listening to loving correction. They're defending and protecting themselves. And the other little ones should long to help them and care for them. And in this situation, Jesus says loving them involves this process. It doesn't involve sweeping their sin under the carpet. That looks superficially kind to say, don't worry about it, it doesn't matter, I'll forget it. But it's not kind, says Jesus. It's not loving, because it leaves them in such a dangerous place. Remember, the key issue here is you can't be part of the new community. You can't be part of Jesus' community without being a little one. And being in Jesus' community is a matter of life and death. If this brother or sister in these verses is being a big one, the danger is they might be outwardly part of the community, but not in their heart. They might come to church regularly, but not be a follower of Jesus in truth. And Jesus says his community should care enough for them to follow this process. Even right to the end, in verse 17, treat them as you would a pagan or a tax collector. That's not saying be mean to them, like you would be mean to tax collectors and pagans. Jesus has already taught his disciples that you love even your enemies. You love tax collectors and pagans. But Jesus is saying to this person who claims to be a little one but is acting like a big one and refused to be helped, the church has got a responsibility to declare, actually, no, we don't think you are in the community. For their own good, so that they realise and turn around and come in. I think that's why we get verse 18, which can look slightly tricky. Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. We saw actually exactly the same words back in chapter 16, and we were learning there that it had to do with the authority the disciples had as they preached the gospel message. As they preached the gospel, people would respond to the gospel, either rejecting it or accepting it. And their response determined their eternal destiny. The gospel preaching of the disciples caused people to be bound or loose, to accept or reject the message. And Jesus was saying in chapter 16, that's not like any other earthly decision. This decision determines spiritual reality, their spiritual state. I think it's really the same idea here in chapter 18. It's all connected to response to the gospel. For this brother who sinned in these verses, the church is declaring, actually, this person has rejected the gospel. Although they claim to have accepted it, they have rejected it. Jesus is giving the church authority in this situation to say that. I think that's the point of the next couple of verses as well, verses 19 and 20, where he says, if two of you agree, it will be done for you by my Father in heaven. Where two or three come together in my name, there I'm with them. I don't think these are actually general statements about God's presence. I don't think this is a general statement. Actually, God is present with us in the room in a special way because there's more than one of us there. And because I think the context determines what they're about. And the context is the church coming together in a matter of judgment. The context is you've taken one or two others along, two or three witnesses, the church comes together. And I think what these verses are saying is the church has the authority to make the call on whether someone's in or not. And what the church says matches up to heavenly reality. The Father will be with them. God authorizes their declaration. It's not that the church, by this statement, makes someone a Christian or not. It's just that we can trust that their judgment in this situation matches up to reality. But we mustn't lose sight of the point of all this process. What's the point of it all? Remember, it's to win back. It's not to put someone outside the kingdom. It's to warn someone that they are outside the community so that they come in. And that, of course, is the most serious problem. Not being part of the community, not believing the gospel. You've got to believe the gospel and come in for the sake of eternal life. Church discipline, which is what this is by another name, I guess can be part of the reason people have a damaged view of the church. I don't know if you've ever read The Scarlet Letter, which is a novel about a young woman in 18th century America who gets pregnant, unmarried, and the supposedly Christian people of the town push her out of society. She has to live on the edge in the woods. She has to wear a scarlet letter A for adulterer. Sewn onto her clothes. And the message is really very unsubtle in the book. Christians are all hypocritical, judgmental, nasty people. But I think a right reading of these verses contradicts that view. That's a caricature. It's a terrible caricature. It's a million miles away from what Jesus is really saying here. This process of discipline is motivated by love. And the whole point of it is not to kick someone out, but desiring deeply to do everything it takes to bring someone in love back in to community. If your child is standing in the middle of the road, love does not honour their choice and leave them there. Love does everything it can to get them out of danger. It's the same key issue here as the rest of the chapter. It really matters that you're part of the new community. The invitation is open to everyone. the gospel declaration is going out via the disciples to everyone. Come in, be part of Jesus' people, be part of his new community. But the issue here is, you can't be part of the community and not be a little one. If you're being a big one, if you're unrepentant in sin, the loving thing for the community to do is everything it takes to wake you up to that. It's a challenge to us little ones. If we're little ones, if we're part of the community, do we care? Do we care enough to take sin seriously? Are we willing to challenge those who've sinned against us privately, in love, seeking to win them back? Are we willing to be challenged, even to be disciplined for our own good? Do we care enough to see this through if we were faced with a church discipline situation? Thankfully, it's very rare to go right to the end of these three steps. But we've got to know why, in love, we would do it. We've got to know why this process is in our church rules document that will be, God willing, accepting in a few weeks together. It's in there. We've got to know why it's there for our own good. Finally, Jesus' third instruction to his new community. Be forgivers who know their huge debt. And looking at the last chunk of the chapter, verse 21 to 35. Be forgivers who know their huge debt. In a sense, there's almost nothing to say because the point of Jesus' parable is so clear, isn't it, when it comes across. It starts, verse 21, Peter asking Jesus this question. I reckon Peter's kind of got the idea about the new community. He's talking to Jesus about generous forgiveness. Apparently, the rabbis of the day said that you should forgive someone up to three, maybe four times. So Peter's kind of getting the idea. He's getting that life in the new community is about caring for one another. So Peter says, let's go a step further. Let's be really generous. Let's say we'll forgive people seven times. But Jesus, of course, it blows that all away. Not seven times, 77 times. His point is that people in his new community should be so shaped by the forgiveness they've been shown that the number of times you forgive is a meaningless question. It's limitless. Remember, only little ones are in the community. The way the community live is shaped by the way people came into it. By huge forgiveness. The central character in the parable is this servant who's forgiven the big debt and won't forget the little debt. He owes, verse 24, 10,000 talents, which is a huge sum of money. I'm told we're talking the equivalent of something like £6 billion today. £6 billion. It's a huge debt that he couldn't possibly ever pay. And he's forgiven it. It's cancelled. That's the position of everyone who's come into Jesus' new community. Because we've rejected God, because by nature we've done and said and thought things that aren't true, that aren't right, that don't honour God, because in Paul's word we've rejected God and turned to worship created things instead of the Creator, we've built up a debt we can't possibly pay. We've got into a situation where we rightly deserve God's judgment and there is no way out on our own. To follow Jesus is to receive forgiveness of that huge debt, to accept him taking the punishment for all of that sin on the cross. Having received that kind of forgiveness, how can Jesus' people not be people who forgive? How can we not be people who are quick to forgive? Even big things. I think I used to think that only a few people in the world were wronged badly and had big things to forgive. And then I grew up a little bit and realised that almost all of us have big wrongs done to us at some point. But they do, hard as it is for us to come to realise, they do pale compared to what we have been forgiven. And this story is emotional, this parable, isn't it? Don't you feel a sense of outrage at how this man acts? It is so clearly obviously wrong for him to choke this fellow servant and demand the payment of the small debt. It's unpleasant to see. And Jesus says to his followers, don't be like that. Jesus' community is a community that's shaped by grace, God's undeserved kindness in forgiving our huge debt. I think this is one of the things that is new about the new community. God's people in the Bible have had good laws about being generous living for a long time, but I think it's only when we know the depth of grace like this, it's only when we see the cross and what Jesus has done for us there, that you can have a community that's truly and utterly shaped by grace. No normal earthly community can be like that. Only one shaped by grace. If you're going to be a community of little ones, if humility is going to be the rule of the community, there's got to be some truth that makes us humble, some truth that shows us that we are all dependent and little. And this is it. The big debt, the huge debt, we've been forgiven. You know, the issue here, once again, is the same as it is in the rest of the chapter. What is life like in the new community? That's the big question. But it's completely bound up with this other question. Who's there? Who's in the new community? Did you notice this man in the parable? He thought that he'd been forgiven. He thought that he'd been forgiven his debt in verse 27. But by the end of the story, he wasn't forgiven his debt. By the end of the story, he's in the jail, verse 34, to be tortured until he should pay back all he owed, which he could never do. He'd had the offer of forgiveness. He thought he'd received it, but he hadn't. In the end, he rejected it. Because if you don't forgive others, you show that you don't truly understand forgiveness and you can't have received it. I guess that's the problem sometimes with the visible church. There could be people like this, who think that they're in, but show that by their actions that they're not. And Jesus lovingly gives us the same warning as the disciples. If you don't live like this, all the way through the chapter he says, if you don't live like this, consider the possibility that you haven't understood the gospel, and yet you're not in at all. Many people shrink from that question in horror. You can't ask people that. Especially not people who've been in church for years. You can't ask people that. But Jesus is willing to ask it. Because to be part of the new community is to be part of the community that lasts for eternity. And to get there, you've got to be changed. I've got to become a little one. And only accepting billion-dollar forgiveness can change you into a little one. Are we willing? I think this chapter forces us to ask, are we willing to say to people who've had a bad experience of church, or just who have bad impressions of what Christian community is like, are we willing to say to them, watch us? Watch us. Watch. Do we dare to say, watch our Christian community? We're not perfect. Certainly not. But we have been changed by Jesus. We have been changed by Jesus and accepting his forgiveness. And you will see the effects of that in our community. It will be different. It is different. Come and see what you think.